Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Dee. Glad to be here today. And hearing Dr. Seidel say that I have anything to add after he speaks would be the same as if Thomas Edison told you the meter man would be by later to explain electricity and the power grid to you. So I'm the meter man, and I've got lots of observations, and I've got a little bit of data. And basically, what we do is try to apply a lot of the things that Dr. Seidel and Dr. Lauderdale and a lot of these other guys that have been around for a long time. We try to apply those things that they've basically come up with. And so I've got observations, and we'll look at a few things this afternoon. And I'll try to make it so that we don't go a whole lot over anymore. But there's a few things just to observe here, some old truths that you can't get away from. And I don't care what kind of program you use, there's just some things we can't change. And then there are some new technologies that we're taking advantage of. And I'm going to talk specifically mainly the embryo transfer. So there's some old truths, and it's not rocket science, but the donor is the largest variable in embryo production. And the reality of it is donors are born with the watchword now is follicular reserve. And every donor's follicular reserve is a little bit different. And the number of embryos that we're going to get out potentially out of these donors are relative to their follicular reserve and also relative to the number of follicles and oocytes they're going to have in any given follicular wave. And it's fairly predictable. And it's not FSH or protocol dependent. You know, there's just some donors out there that have small waves and small numbers of oocytes that doesn't matter how much FSH you give them, you're not going to change that. And it's not the practitioner in the sense that there are certainly things we can do to tweak them and try to get more embryos out and mainly get better stimulations. But the reality of it is she's in control. And a lot of times it's not the environment. Now, that's not to say that if you put them in a bad environment that you can't certainly reduce embryo output. But just because you put them in an ideal environment doesn't necessarily mean they're going to do better either. So, and like I say, it's not rocket science, but it's just one of those things that you have to accept. And I've had clients tell me that what they're going to do is find a donor that works real well, makes a lot of embryos, and then just learn to love her. And that's probably not a bad idea. And then the recip is the largest variable in conception rate. There again, it's generally not the embryo. While the embryo can have an effect, you can certainly have a donor effect. Some donors' embryos are a little more fertile than others. And there again, it's probably not the practitioner. If you're using somebody that does embryo transfer and has some experience, it'd be unusual for it to be the practitioner. And of course, we're always looking for reasons for failure or less than optimal results. But generally speaking, for whatever that means, it's the recip. More than any other factor. And the single biggest variable in small groups, and we work with people that have, you know, basically one donor to 50 donors and one recip to 200 recips at a time. And as your group size gets smaller, the fact of it is there again that chance becomes a larger variable. And the best explanation I have that is we go out and we transfer 100 embryos, and we get 60 of them pregnant, everybody's pretty happy. But if you go back and you break those down into tens, you're going to have ranges there. You know, and the reality of it is you're just as likely to get 3 for 10 as you are 9 for 10. And if you look at those groups of 10, you'll undoubtedly see it. And it's a little bit like Dee said, you know, the bull that you got 2 out of 10 pregnant on, it's not time to blame the bull. It's time to think that maybe chance is a bigger factor there than we want to give it credit. And the reality of it is, it's quite often that's what it is. The problem with that is if you try to fix chance, you're going to be chasing your tail. And so we try to sort of keep that in the back of our mind. So we'll talk about some technologies that we used. And I'm going to talk about the last 20 years. And I have been at this a little bit more than 30 years, but I don't remember the first 10 now. My memory's gotten to be sort of like a rolling herd average. I add a year and drop a year. And so I'm stuck on 20 right now, and I'm sure it'll get less. But it's been a very exciting time to be in practice. Ultrasound has really changed changed practice, the old machines, and that was the old Alloca 500, and those are still really good machines, but we've all gone to the more portable machines, and that's the ones they have out here, an older model of it. But it's really changed practice and changed reproduction. A lot of these guys out here that did all the original work have really revolutionized reproduction in cattle. So for embryo transfer and ultrasound in general, and this has been covered some, but why do we want an ultrasound? Well, you can diagnose pregnancies earlier. In my opinion, for the most part, you can diagnose them more accurately. I heard Brad Stroud say an ultrasound, the difference between ultrasound and palpation is like you've got a pocket full of coins in your pocket. Well, if you palpate them, you know what they are. If you take an ultrasound, you can say you've got a nickel, a dime, a penny, and so forth. And so it's a pretty good analogy, I think. It's less invasive, and that's relative to the operator, just like palpation is relative to the operator, depending on how invasive that is. You can certainly confirm fetal viability. Experienced palpators can do that sometimes, but literally, we've had some come in the chute that looked like the fetus died, you know, coming down the alley. And that's not a great big reason to use it because the incidence is relatively low, but it's just a nice added benefit. You can diagnose fetal anomalies, which there again, not a great big deal because hopefully we're not having a lot of those, but it's another added benefit. We can certainly fetal sex and an embryo transfer. That's probably where we use that more than anywhere else. Gives the breeder a chance to do some planning for the future if he knows what's coming. You can make sure you got your bull contracts filled. You can market and merchandise some pregnancies that way as well. And another big way we use it is to assess superovulation before breeding. Now, we don't house a lot of donors, and I wish we housed more. But the ones that we do house, it gives us the ability to sort of get an idea of how well she's stimulated before we thaw semen. And the way we do it is we generally just look at those ovaries about 24 hours before anticipated heat, which is at seed removal, and just give us an idea of what kind of response we have. So if we're going to use valuable semen, we might have a first choice, second choice, so that the valuable semen on a less than optimal superovulation we'll just leave in the tank and go to something else. And the big thing is it's helped us understand follicular dynamics. And like I say, for me, in my career, that's probably been the single biggest thing. And we're probably all sick and tired of follicular waves. But this is the basis of all the synchronization programs we use for AI, all the synchronization programs we use for ET, for the recip and the donor. This has been a critical discovery, really, for setting up our donors as well. And so you ought to understand that, know it happens, and just realize the importance of it. So let's talk about just a little bit about synchronization programs, and it'll be a little bit because they've been covered. But the point I want to make is every day there's a new name, right? And we'll probably have three or four more before we get out of here. And I can't remember them. I keep some on my phone just to remember some of the names and some of the principles there. But really, instead of trying to memorize all the different programs, you really ought to just know what the three tools are. And all those programs and all the programs we have, whether we're looking at, there again, recips or AIs or donors, it really comes down to just three tools. And just to review those real quickly, prostaglandin, which is estromate, prostamate, or luteolysis, really just does one thing. It has more than one effect, but we're after just one thing when we give it to an animal, and that is just to regress the CL. And then you've got GnRH, that's your second tool. And GnRH causes an LH surge from the pituitary. And what does it do? Well, it depends on where she is in her cycle. If she's mid-cycle, she's got a CL, and she's got a follicle that's in that 6 or 7 or 8 millimeter range that would have LH receptors, then it'll turn that follicle over, and it'll sort of, it's kind of like hitting the reset button on your computer. It just resets that follicular wave, and you'll get new follicular wave emergence there. If you don't have a CL and you're near a heat, then you'll get ovulation of that follicle. So basically, those are the two things we use GnRH for. And then we've got progestins, and basically we're talking about either MGA or cedars. And just a simple, my simple mind, the way I think about that is just think of it as an artificial CL. Mid-cycle is probably not doing a whole lot, right? But as she approaches a heat, then it'll have an effect there. And it can be a positive effect or a negative effect, depending on how you use it and what your intent is. Okay? So let's talk about superovulation just a little bit. And maybe we'll look at follicular waves or the concept just a little bit different. In our potential donor here, we have an FSH phase or FSH-dependent phase where we get new follicular wave emergence. And we have this little cohort of follicles there. And this is what I was talking about a while ago. Some cows will fairly predictably have larger numbers of these and some will have smaller. And you just can't have much effect on that, the reality of it is. And what we want to do is before this one follicle is selected, and you've got all these, before we have any selection or dominance, we want to start our FSH right here, right? And we want to grow these follicles to bigger ones, like they're all big, going to be dominant ovulatory follicles. And then it really, one concept is when we're given FSH, if we weren't given FSH here, we'd have a single ovulation, right? And so one concept is all these atretic, all these follicles here become atretic, and we're kind of doing missionary work here to some degree. We're saving these follicles or these oocytes, which, by the way, will be gone forever if we don't use them. And so you don't burn cows up using FSH on them. These things are lost at a steady rate, okay? And so we want to give that FSH, let those follicles develop LH receptors, and we get multiple ovulations. And just sort of Mickey Mouse, there again, my simple mind physiology, that's pretty much what there is to superovulating a donor. Some of this part of it, we have control over it, and unfortunately some of it is genetic, and we don't have control over it. So the old way, the way that's been around forever is we get a start heat, a reference heat here, and we'll call that day zero, and we'll wait about 7 to 13 days, and we'll begin our FSH protocol. And no matter whose protocol you use, whether it's Tom's or Alan Strecker's or whoever's, there's probably going to all be pretty similar and going to work pretty much the same. But the reality of it is this is what happens. You have a client that calls you, and he's got donors that aren't into that 7 to 13 day range. And so we need to do something to reset those so we can start them all on our protocol at the same time. We'd like to start our FSH at the same time. We'd like to have them in heat at the same time so we can consequently collect them at the same time. Because a lot of times we're traveling from remote distances. And the other thing, it's a larger pain in the butt for you guys to have 2 days instead of 1 day as well. And it's generally more expensive. So this is sort of our goal here. Of the program that we'd like to use as opposed to getting just a reference heat. So how do we do that? Well, where we're at right now, and this is the protocol we're using, is on day zero, and kind of forget these numbers down here at the bottom, any day of the cycle, okay? Any day of the cycle, we're going to put a seeder in on day zero, and then 2 days later, we're going to reset the follicular wave, and hopefully she'll have a follicle there that we can ovulate. If she doesn't, then I'm just going to hope that she's near follicular wave emergence, and that's why we don't have a follicle there that GnRH would cause to ovulate. And then 2 days after that, which is to be about the time of follicular wave emergence, then we'll start our FSH. Now, one reason, this is a 16-day cycle for me, and one reason, there's a couple reasons we're doing this cedar right here. We were doing it coincident with the GnRH. One reason we're doing this is simply logistics for us. Our recipient programs are all 16 days long, and this makes our donor program 16 days long. So clients can do it all at one time. Believe it or not, some of them will kind of forget it. If you give them too many programs, then it just makes it a little bit more confusing. And one thing we try to do is make it as easy and as rememberable as possible. So we're not changing things from one part to another. Another reason is one little hole here. If you happen to have a follicle that was about to ovulate, then this cedar should hold it, create a persistent follicle, then it would respond to your GnRH. So maybe it fixes one little spot, but probably the biggest reason is it's the same length of time, setup time as our recips. Okay? So I wanted to compare this, and this isn't in the you don't have this slide, and the old gold standard, and we got to talk about this last night with Dr. Lauderdale, some, and Dr. Patterson, and the old standard before, and if you notice the date on this, the building's not shaking. That's me. 2006. We used an estradiol progesterone combination. This was very predictable. It caused a new follicular wave emergence. But in April of that year, FDA and CVM came out and banned that substance. Okay, so we're not able to use estradiol anymore. And I gave this data last week at the ATA, and I decided to share it with you guys just to show you we don't need estradiol anymore. So I looked at about 3,200 collections over a period of time that was a little bit less than 4 years. And then I looked at our current data that's all GnRH data, and it's the same program that we just looked at, okay? And exact same time period, so we had the same number of seasons. I don't have an extra summer in there and all that kind of stuff. For what it's worth, this would be 90% beef, 10% dairy, and discarding about 70% of the grade threes. So we looked at the numbers, and I was asked to do this and told them I would before I actually looked at the numbers, so I was fairly glad they turned out like that. And so there's just no difference there. And if you're wondering why there's a spread in here, it's because I didn't know what I was doing right in there. I couldn't with 100% confidence say, well, you know, what the synchronization program was. So that's the reason there's that time in there. So just to get it out there, if you're using estradiol, anybody in this room, whether it's for a donor, a recip, or an AI program, you need to quit because it's just a matter before it's going to cause a problem, not just for you or your client, but potentially for an industry. So I just want to say that. And if you need this, and I've got this in a paper form, if anybody wants it, you know, email me and I'll send it to you if you need a little help convincing somebody, okay? So that seven, so we averaged about seven or so, right? And that doesn't look too bad. But let's look at it a little bit more broken down as a little differently by donors a little bit more. And this is an old data set. This is probably 15 years old now that I've put together. This is all Angus cattle. There were 637 collections on 505 donors, so some of them obviously were done more than once. And sort of the bottom line is we averaged about eight, okay? So if you ask me how many embryos am I going to get out of a donor, or if a veterinarian wants me to tell him what he should tell his client, well, I'll tell him, you know, you're going to get about, depending on the breed, you're going to probably get seven or eight embryos out of them, right? But then if the client says, well, how many, and I tell him that, the most likely thing I'm going to get is seven or eight, right? Because this is just a shotgun blast there. It's a complete crapshoot. You're going to, 13% of the time, you're going to get none to transfer. Now, you might get 20, but they're not any good if you're with me there. 20% of the time, you're going to get one or less. Well, the flip side of that, 11% of the time, you're going to get 18 or more. And so it's not the kind of distribution that lends itself to good budgeting, but it's just the way it is. Now, if you set up 5 donors or 10 donors in a day, I'll bet you'll get 7 or 8. But what you're probably not going to get with a single donor is the average. And the point of that is, I guess, is mainly from a budgeting standpoint. Or there again, those small numbers and chance thing we were talking about a while ago, whereas chance becomes a pretty big factor in that. Now, the reality of it is, like I said a while ago, these donors over here are probably going to act like that again. And these donors are probably going to act like this again to some degree. You know, it's not one-to-one, but it is somewhat repeatable. And I always let a donor fail one time before I get too excited about her. But if she's failed for me for 3 times consecutively on different treatments and different things we've done, and you can define failure any way you want, then, you know, she's probably going to be tough. And that's where you probably ought to try to find another cow to love, you know. Okay? So that's it for me on donors. So let's talk about recips a little bit. And for embryos, I really don't care what program you know, if you've got a flavor of the month or the year, whatever you want to use for recips, you can. just remember that a lot of your AI protocols work fine for putting embryos in behind them on day seven, but we're also doing a lot of things to set animals up to breed that we really don't need to do for recips. You know, we're worried about ovulating a nice, healthy oocyte and a big follicle and having lots of progesterone, which we do want for our embryo. But that healthy oocyte, we don't care about. All we want is a nice, big, robust CL there. The flip side of that is some of the programs we write, we actually induce that persistent follicle. And if you induce a persistent follicle and then try to breed behind it, you're probably not going to get along quite as well. So just a word of caution there on that. Unfortunately, some programs end up like this, where you don't get very good synchrony, and then you end up having to transfer embryos over several days. And obvious for us that are doing this, we don't really want to make more than one farm visit. It's not the most efficient thing. And for you guys, you probably don't want to gather cattle more than you have to either. So our gold standard, just like our gold standard for our donor program, here's our gold standard for our recips. We want to have a program that gives us a nice, tight heat here, and then about 7 days later, we're going to come back in and put embryos in. So just to give a couple examples, and I'll get the names wrong on them, but this is what I call Cedar Select, and I hope that's right. And this would just be a heat detection program. And like I say, there's nothing special about this. Use any of them you want, but it's GnRH and a cedar on day zero. Leave your cedar in 7 days or 8 days. Pull your cedar, give prostaglandin, and then heat check. And if you want to back your prostaglandin up some, you can, but it's another trip down the chute, so a lot of the guys I work for don't. And then 7 days later, plus or minus about 1.5 days, so 6 to 8 days, we're going to come about 7 days later, but we'll heat check them for about 72 hours, and then we'll come try to mix and match embryos to put our stages of embryos with our correct recipient synchronization or time of heat. So that's one. But this is the one that we're using 99% of the time now, and we've used it for 15 years. We did an original thing with Bill at Tech on on-time transfers nearly, like I say, 20 years ago now. And we really had treatment groups and control groups and the whole nine yards. And this is the one I kind of went to the field with back then. And my clients really have chosen this as their synchronization program for their ET programs. We reserved it for large groups to start with, but anymore, it's just the one they use. And like I say, I tell every one of them I don't care, but this is the one they pick. So cedar in on day zero, GnRH, same time, cedar 7 or 8 days, prostaglandin, and then I've got 48 hours down here, and that's what we generally do, but roughly 48 to 54 hours we'll give GnRH. 7 days later, I'll show up. We'll put embryos in. Everybody that goes on this end will go down the chute. And so, you know, if you set up 100 recips, I want to see all 100 of them. And just on the average, we'll transfer about 80 to 85% of the embryos into those recips as long as they're a good cycling group. And it works. And I've got tons and tons of data on it. And we get along. And I dug this out last night, and that's not in there either. This I robbed the bar graphs out of the thing that Bill did, and Bill and I did, and this is just from the synchronization here, just to give you some idea of what kind of distribution you ought to have. And this was the one treatment group that had 165 animals in it. They were all fitted with heat watch patches, and that's the kind of distribution. At 36 hours. After you pull your cedar and give prostaglandin, you're going to get your first heats. And then at 48 hours, we gave GnRH. And you still get a fair amount of heats at the 60-hour mark, but GnRH shuts them down, right? Somebody said, you know, if you're going to screw a synchronization schedule up and you're going to have to put the bull in, make sure you don't give GnRH. Well, that's why right here, because that's going to shut them down about 12 hours after your GnRH. That LH will ovulate that follicle, or at least it'll start the cascade of events that leads to ovulation, and one of those events is to shut down steroidogenesis. So if she's not in heat, she's not going to come into heat.